tuned in to the Community Cats podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Hey there, this is Kristen, the Community Cats podcast technical tabby. You'll be hearing from Stacey LeBaron, our usual host, who's been helping save cats for more than 20 years at the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society, among other organizations, a little later in this episode, but I'm just popping in to let you know that this is part two of a special podcast entitled Return to Field, How Shelters Save Community Cats. This is the audio-only version of an advanced webinar that was given by Brian Cordes and Susie Richmond, who are the experts on feral cats over at Neighborhood Cats. They do lots of webinars in conjunction with Community Cats podcast, and we adore every chance that we get to work with them. In the second part, you're going to learn about how a cat moves through a return to field program and what happens at each stage, what kind of questions you'll need to ask the finder, because you're only really going to get one chance to do that most of the time, if you'll need to keep the cats in cages or if it's all right to keep them in their traps, and how to get the return exactly right. And it seems like that should be easy. You just open the door and let the cat go, but it's a bit more complicated than that, and Brian will get into it. He'll also give you a few scenarios where targeted TNR and return to field are used together to improve outcomes for cats. Plus, there's another awesome Q&A and a conversation with Stacey at the end that you absolutely don't want to miss, so hang on for that. If you want to check out the recording of this with all of the visuals, which are fabulous, Brian takes great pictures, I set up a handy link for you guys. It's communitycatspodcast.com/everythingTNR, and that will take you right to our Everything TNR playlist where we've collected the full versions of all of the free webinars presented by Neighborhood Cats. So if you go check that out, you're definitely going to be glad that you did. In the meantime, don't forget what Stacey always says, that the goal of this podcast is to help you turn your passion for cats into action. And as you're listening to this episode, maybe think about a few of the tips and tricks that they're going to give you and how you can implement them to do just that in your community.
Okay. So again, we're going to get into the nuts and bolts, and then we'll talk a little bit about, like I mentioned, about how do you combine return to field with TNR to have the most impact. This is the kind of flow. This slide shows you the flow of a return to field program. The cat comes into the shelter, and that's when you have your greatest opportunity to gather information about that cat. How do you explain to the people who are bringing the cats in that we call them finders is the technical term for the person who found the cat and brought the cat in. And it's also important to understand that finders may have multiple motivations. They may dislike cats and want to get them out of their backyard. On the other hand, they may see a stray cat and think this cat needs help, so I'm going to bring them to the shelter. There may be multiple reasons why people surrender cats. So then once the cat is in the system and you've gotten all the information you can, you have to assess eligibility for the program. If they're going to be in the program, of course, you have to keep them somewhere in the shelter. Then you have the surgery. There's the return of the cat. And then there's how do you deal with issues that come up after the cat is returned. So we're going to go over each of those topics. So this is really just a crucial stage when the cat is first brought in. And it's really important to train your staff to be able to gather as much information as possible, because that's the moment that you may never see the finder again, the person who brings the cat in, or get an opportunity to talk to them. So you have to have forms and questions and know what you need before they show up. And that's in the Return to Field Handbook. You'll find some sample questionnaires that you can build off of, and they should be standardized, and everyone who deals with intake should have that right there ready to go and run down the list of questions. So the things you're going to want to know that are crucial are the location of origin. Where did this cat come from? Now, sometimes what happens at intake is people will look at the finder's driver's license and write down their address, but that may not be where the cat came from. You want the finder's address for sure, their residential address, but you have to specifically ask them, is this where you trapped the cat? Because it may have been somewhere else. Also, if they're having trouble identifying a specific address, then you want to go quickly to Google Maps and work with them to pinpoint exactly where the trapping took place. You want to ask about the cat's history. So are they a recent arrival? Is this a cat that has never been seen before? On the other hand, is this a cat who's been around the neighborhood for years? Are they showing any signs of illness? Is that behind what brought the cat in? What is their behavior at the time of the capture? So For example, we had a cat who showed up on someone's porch and then didn't leave the porch for like 2 weeks. The finder put food out for the cat, but the cat would not budge off the porch. So what does that tell you? It tells you that, first of all, the cat hadn't been seen before, so appears to have been new to the neighborhood. A cat that was comfortable in his environment would not have stayed on the porch nonstop for 2 weeks. They would have had their figured out, if I found another kind soul who's going to put food out for me, they would have had their meal and then they would have continued on their way. But a cat that won't move from a location is unfamiliar and scared. So all of that would point to the cat having been recently abandoned. And when we dug into it further, we found out that indeed the finder's neighbor had recently moved and left their cats behind. So having that kind of specific information about how the cat was acting, what were the circumstances of the cats being brought in, is a huge clue as to whether or not they should be in a return to field program. In that case, of course, they should not have been. Other cats in the area, are community cats commonly seen? Is there some kind of construction project that would make it dangerous to go back? So, and why did the person bring the cat in? Did they feel sorry for the cat? Are they hostile to the cat? Are there too many cats reproducing? Is that an area that needs TNR attention? And then what's the finder's attitude? Are they being hostile or cooperative? You'd be so, again, there's often a common assumption that the person bringing the cat in hates cats, right? But that's only some of the time. A lot of people are just concerned about the cat, or they see the shelter, they think the shelter is going to a safer place or whatever it might be. And when a return to field is explained to them, they're fine with it. And sometimes they'll just pick up the cat and bring them back themselves. So this conversation needs to happen at intake. So how do you talk to the people coming in about the fact that the cat may come back? And so the first question is whether you have to answer as a program is, do you want to discuss return to field with the finder or not? Some shelters don't. I know in Jacksonville, in the first program, in the beginning, they did a lot of talking to people who brought the cats in, and then they just found themselves getting into a lot of arguments that were not productive. So they stopped talking about it. Other programs, like here in Maui, they do talk to people, and the culture is such that it's often really beneficial. And once the people are a little more educated and understand that it's better for the cat and it'll be better for them. And if the cat were not to be returned, they're just going to end up with the same problem with a different cat. And it's better just to have a spayed and neutered cat in place than to have a kind of revolving door of intact cats. So that's a policy choice to make. One thing you can do if you want to avoid this kind of discussion but still provide notice is to put return to field in your surrender forms. So almost every shelter has the finder sign a form giving the shelter legal custody and ownership of the cat. And that form typically relates what the possible outcomes for the cat are, including adoption, euthanasia. Well, return to field can be listed as one of the options that may happen. And in that way, the person is notified. And also, again, I think I mentioned that having this conversation can turn it from a return to field to a TNR, meaning that the finder, once they understand what's going on and that it's better for the cat to go back outside, they'll actually come and pick up the cat and return them themselves. If there are specific complaints, like somebody doesn't want the cats in their backyard, well, then you have an opportunity to explain ways to keep the cats out, such as motion-activated sprinklers or ultrasonic devices, things that deter cats from entering certain areas. So a lot of shelters with return to field programs also have a nice stock of motion activated sprinklers that they'll lend out. And usually after a period of time, maybe a month or two, the cats are trained not to come into the yard. So again, having that conversation creates opportunities. Whether it's worth it or not is something that you'll have to decide as an agency. But I would recommend that you try it. And you might be surprised that it turns out well, more than you thought it would. So then we get to, once you've gathered all the information, you need to assess whether or not the cat should actually be in a program. And first question is, who decides? Who makes that call? And it could be admissions, could be the people who are actually taking the cats in. That really depends on who is on your staff. At a lot of shelters, there's a lot of turnover on the customer service side, the public-facing side. And it can be difficult to have somebody there who's adequately trained and experienced to be making these decisions. Now, if you've got somebody there who has those qualifications, then having them make the call on which route the cat's going to take can be very time efficient and save a lot of resources. But if you've got somebody who's brand new to animal welfare and has been on the job for 2 months and doesn't know a lot about cats, you probably don't want that person to be the decision maker. So what shelters often do is they have specially assigned staff. It might be the community cat coordinator or manager, somebody who is experienced, who will look over the information. So that's what Neighborhood Cats does in New York City. We'll look over the information that the shelter gathers, ask questions, maybe get a behavioral assessment, things like that, and then make a decision. So given our experience, we're probably in a better position to do that than somebody who's new and as a customer service representative. Some shelters actually will take a team approach. They'll have a veterinarian input. They'll have the community cat coordinator's input, whoever has expertise to lend, and they'll make a group decision. That's a great approach, but of course, it can be a lot more time consuming to do it that way. And an agency may just not have the luxury of that kind of thing. So you really have to decide what works best for your organization. When you're looking at the cat, him or herself, these are the things you're looking at. Number one is their health. If they're coming in and they're not thriving, they're underweight, they've got severe respiratory issues, you don't want to put the cat back out. That means they're not doing well in their territory. We want to be putting cats back in situations that they were doing where they're healthy and they're doing okay. Do they have some type of disability that makes it more dangerous for them? That can depend a lot on the other factors, which is what are the circumstances where they live? They live in a nice, quiet, suburban area with lots of trees and green lawns, or are they, you know, is it the back alley of a densely urban city where some type of disability might be like missing a leg, something like that might be a real threat to them. Although always keep in mind that if you have a three-legged cat who lives in what you think is a difficult area, but they've been there for 5 years, well, they're doing okay. They figured it out. So all these things kind of combine. Age, if the cats are young enough to easily socialize, then yeah, and there's any way you can fit them into your program, probably a good idea not to release them, but to put them on an adoption track. But that really depends a lot on capacity and things like that. Their temperament, if they're really taking into account that almost all cats will appear somewhat frightened at first. Some of them won't be. Some of them warm up right away. But you need to give cats, if we're uncertain about a cat's temperament, we'll ask the shelter if they can hold them for a few more days and reassess their temperament once they've had a chance to calm down. Also, what was their behavior when they were outside? Were they very friendly with people? Did they keep their distance? So all these things kind of tell you whether this is a cat who should be put back outside. Also the location of origin, as we've mentioned, are there going to be any major pending changes? Was there a feeder who's brought the cats in because they're moving and nobody else, their food source will be gone? Or is there going to be major construction and the house they're living in is going to be knocked down? Or have there been repeated reports of poisonings in that area? These are all things you want to take into account. You also, at intake, gives you a chance to assess the finder. Because remember, we talked about the fear that the cats will be harmed because by the people who brought them in. Our experience is the vast majority of people are not going to become animal abusers overnight because a cat came back outside. They're not cruel people. They just, for whatever reason, didn't want the cat there. But if you get somebody who's really hostile and really, and you're legitimately concerned that this could be a violent person, then you might not want to return them. But keep in mind that often people act that way because they're trying to intimidate you or bully you into thinking that the cat is, you know, danger. So somebody being angry by itself is not really enough to say, oh, this cat, this person is a risk. But sometimes there are indications that, yeah, this is not a good, you know, this person could cause harm, but that's going to be pretty rare. What's the risk to wildlife? But you don't want to put a cat back in a bird sanctuary. So that's a consideration in most cases that people are not going to be facing, but it's something to be aware of because once in a while, that is a factor. And we want to be careful about that. You know, you're not doing anybody, including the cat, any favors by putting them in an area where they're potentially going to cause harm. And it's an area that should be safe for birds or animals that might be otherwise threatened by predation. What's the likelihood the cat is owned? Again, that comes down to what were the circumstances that the cat was brought in? And are there other caretakers and neighbors waiting for the cat's return? Sometimes what happens is a cat is brought in, and then the people who've been taking care of the cat in the neighborhood, a true community cat who has multiple feeders, they get upset that somebody grabbed the cat and surrendered them, and they want them back. So that would have a lot to do with suitability for return. So then we get to what we were talking about before, which is friendly cats and kittens. So again, we go back to who is a community cat, and they're not all ferals. Some of them are very friendly in the field, but not so friendly when you take them out of their territory. Some of them have people who love them and have been caring for them, and they have quite a happy life as a neighborhood cat. On the other hand, some of them might be at high risk because they don't have the instinct to run away, and that could potentially, if somebody wanted to do harm, they easily could. So the things to consider are, number one, what is the shelter's capacity for care? So you're not doing any of the cats a favor if you're, you know, you have a capacity for 100 cats and you've crammed 200 in there because they're all going to get sick and it's going to be very difficult to adopt them and things like that. So you have to be realistic about if you think a cat, you want to not friendly cat back outside and you want to rehome them, are you able to do that? Do you have the capacity to do that in a way that's healthy and humane? And if you don't, then that's a factor that leans in favor of returning the cat. What's the cat's history, community ties? We've kind of talked about that. And as I said, what we recommend is an individual assessment of what's the best available outcome for that cat, taking all these things into account: capacity for care, the cat's history, what are the known ties. Our default at neighborhood cats is our presumption is that friendly cats belong in homes. And if we don't have evidence that the cat is doing well and wanted in the community, then we will not return the cat. So often these guys come in and there's very little history, and the finder just saw the cat for the first time, and all they can tell you is, yeah, I saw the cat sitting on this doorstep, so I picked him up and I brought him in. I don't know anything more about it. If we have no history on a friendly cat, we will not return the cat. But that has a lot to do with, you know, capacity for care and our individual assessments. So that's, you know, it's a tough issue, and it's going to vary from shelter to shelter where you come down. But the thing that I really caution, where shelters get into trouble with return to field programs is when they try to put it on autopilot and they say, like, they have criteria like, well, if the cat's over 4 months old and he's in good body condition, the cat is going back. And there's no individual assessment made. It's just automatically the cat goes back. And then you're going to end up returning a cat who really shouldn't go back, and you're going to get into a lot of trouble. And that's what happened in San Diego at a shelter that returned a very friendly cat who really, the circumstances were not favorable. And the cat was adoptable, and there was space at the shelter, but they kind of had this autopilot rule that if the cat came from outside and he's healthy, he goes back outside. And now they're facing a lawsuit. So you can avoid that if you treat each cat as an individual, make a reasonable decision based on that assessment. And then it doesn't mean it's going to work out well every time, but you're not doing it randomly, and you'll have handled it in a responsible way that you can justify later if you need to. Hey, how do you house these cats? Generally, you want to keep them, once you've determined they're going to be returned to field, you want to keep them separate from the general population, especially from dogs, who can really kind of make them nervous and frightened, just the sound. You want a space that's typical holding space for a TNR project, warm, dry, and secure. What you see in this photo, in this slide, is at the Maui Humane Society, they took what had been a drop-off, overnight drop-off space kennel, and transformed it into a community cat holding room. And you can see the cats are kept in traps and cared for. The traps double as cages. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And you want it, if you can, to be, if you have an on-campus clinic, you don't want the housing to be inconvenient. So somebody has to travel, walk up three flights of stairs or something like, or down, something like that, have it so it's easy to get to the clinic or to wherever a van can pull up, something like that. Think about those logistics. In terms of equipment, the traps on tables are really what we recommend as the most economically and space-wise efficient way to go about it. Some shelters really just want to put the cats in cages. If you do, your best piece of equipment is what's called a feral cat den, and you can see it inside the cage here. The dens have what are called porthole doors on their sides, and you can reach in with like a broomstick or something, and you can open and close that side door without opening the cage door. So when you want to clean the cage, the feral cat's going to run into the den as soon as he sees you, and then you can tip that porthole door closed, open the cage door, take the den out, clean the cage, put the den back in, tip the door open. Another factor that's going to determine is what's the length of the stray hold where you are. If it's like 7 or 10 days or something like that, then maybe you want to use cages for these guys and not. But if it's only like, if there is no stray hold or it's a short one, then we recommend you just leave them in the traps. Just an interesting issue about stray holds. And in the state of Arizona, they actually passed a law exempting return to field cats from stray holds because they recognized it's one of the things you want to do is with a return to field program is get the cat in and out as quickly as you can. That maximizes the efficiencies of space, reduces the health risks. So in Arizona, they actually just waived it. And if you're interested, this is the language of that statute if you want to try to get stray cat holds waived in your jurisdiction. So if caring for cats in traps, you need traps that are at least 30 inches in length that have a sliding rear door. You need trap dividers, which is what you see, those little pitchfork-looking things in this slide, sheets to cover the traps. And there is a video on our website. If you click on that link or you follow that path, there's a short video that demonstrates exactly how to take care of a cat in a trap. And believe me, we've done it with thousands of cats. And if you're keeping in there for like 3, 4, 5 days, it's perfectly humane. And actually, if you take a feral cat and you put them in a big cage and you put a cardboard box in it, they're going to spend the whole time in the cardboard box looking for a place to hide. But they're actually much more comfortable in a good-sized trap with a sheet over the top of it. You want to keep track. This is an example of a form, and you can see how it's tied in a plastic sleeve to the front of the trap, so it always travels with the cat. So you're welcome to copy this and adapt it for your own. Again, you'll find examples in the Return to Field Handbook. Surgery. Again, as I mentioned, the faster the cat cycles through your system, the more benefit there will be to the shelter. So what shelters do when they have the resources, like a clinic on campus or a good relationship with a high volume clinic, is they give priority to the return to field cats. So you don't want them sitting around for days waiting for surgery. They come in on Tuesday, you want them fixed on Wednesday and back outside on Thursday. Standard is spay, neuter, ear tip, rabies vaccines where that's legally required. Other optional treatments are FVRCP vaccine, parasite medications, possibly dentals, treatment for injuries or illness. To recognize this may be the only time this cat is in front of a veterinarian, so the most you can do is great. On the other hand, if you're dealing with a high volume of cats and you're stretched for resources, if you just do the standard, that's still a huge benefit for the animal. Typically, recovery time is overnight, especially if you're dealing with a highly skilled surgeon who makes very small incisions for the spays. So we get to the point where the cat is going, you know, has been fixed and is now going back out. The first question about the returns is who does them? There isn't a right or wrong answer. It's just something you have to decide. You can have shelter staff doing the returns. You can have animal control officers. You could have just shelter volunteers, or you could have a partner or a group. So at the Maui Humane Society for a couple of years, the shelter handled the intake, they handled the spay and neuter surgery, and then neighborhood cats handled the returns. And that after a while, they decided to hire their own staff because we wanted to do other things besides return cats all over the place. So they ended up, as their program expanded, and they hired a community cat manager and then an assistant for the manager, they were able to bring the return part in-house. So no right or wrong, just a question of making that decision. For some shelters, having a partner group is also legally gets them out of what they may consider to be a bind, like they may feel like their contract or state law or something like that prohibits them as a shelter from actually releasing cats outside, but it may be perfectly legal for a TNR group to do that or something. So that's a good place for a partnership too. So before the cat is returned, and I think it's important to emphasize that it's not, you know, if you just think like, oh, okay, you pick up the cat, you put him in the back of the van, you drive to the address, you let him go. That's not the gold standard on how to do this. You want to put a little thought and effort into the return for the both the safety of the cat and the safety of the person doing the return.
Are you passionate about spay-neuter? Do you want to create more low-cost opportunities for spay-neuter in your hometown? If this sounds like you, then there's a brand new podcast you'll definitely want to check out. Tune in to United We Spay, a monthly podcast from our friends at United Spay Alliance, hosted by me, Stacey LeBaron. Each episode delves into the heart of the spay-neuter movement, addressing root causes of overpopulation and empowering communities for a brighter future. On United We Spay, we answer tough questions, shift the conversation from symptoms to prevention, and champion solutions for limited access to affordable spay-neuter services. United We Spay is your go-to source for making a difference, spreading knowledge, and elevating the conversation around the importance of spay-neuter. Available now wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to like and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Ready for a grant challenge like no other? Mark your calendars for this inclusive 2024 Open Arms Challenge. For the entire month of April 2024, animal shelters, foster-based organizations, and public charities are encouraged to create a new program or expand an existing one focused on keeping pets and people together. Learn more about how to register and important dates at maddiesfund.org.
Have you ever wished your cat could talk to you? Well, get ready for an event that will help you better understand your feline friend's needs, thoughts, and feelings by observing their behavior. Join us on April 20th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. for the Community Cats Podcast's annual Online Behavior Day. It's a full day packed with invaluable insights and expertise from our dream team of feline behaviorists, all focused on unraveling the mysteries of cat behavior. Dive into workshops covering a range of feline behavior concerns, from enrichment strategies and kitten training to tackling preventable behavior issues that can often lead to surrender, and managing harmony in a multi-cat household. We'll even discuss pet safety. Alongside fascinating workshops, we're spicing things up with fun cat trivia and exciting prizes to keep you engaged and entertained throughout the day. Plus, you'll have a chance to network with fellow professionals and volunteers in the animal welfare sphere, sharing experiences and strategies to better the lives of our kitty companions. So whether you're a seasoned rescuer, a passionate volunteer, or simply a cat enthusiast eager to better understand your kitty, mark your calendars for April 20th and join us for an unforgettable day dedicated to understanding and improving feline behavior. Get all the details and register online today at communitycatspodcast.com/behavior day. That's communitycatspodcast.com/behavior day.
So we have had a checklist anyway, and this is what it was. And we went through these steps before the cat got loaded into the van. So make sure that there's medical approval. Somebody's medical has put eyes on the cat before the return happens. Sometimes, especially when it gets real busy, someone may forget how shelters will put like a paper collar on, or sometimes not just paper, like a plastic collar with an attached ID so the cat doesn't get lost in the shelter system. But sometimes they forget to take them off. And so you want to confirm that the cat does not have some collar that you'll never be able to get off again. Sometimes with that notion that cats cool off, they need a little time to cool off, if there's a borderline case, we'll recheck their behavior. Have they warmed up? Are they making eye contact with us? Are they talking to us? Have they had enough time to now reveal themselves to be much more social than they acted when they came in? That doesn't happen often, but it does happen sometimes, so it's worth doing. You want to verify you have a valid address before you go driving out there. Sometimes mistakes are made on entry. Sometimes, you know, just not enough information was gathered. Sometimes people, again, rare, but it happens where they just give you a fake address. So what we'll do is before we go anywhere, we scout the release site on Google Maps. We'll enter the address and make sure that it exists and where it is. And then finally, make sure that whatever piece of equipment you're transporting a cat in is locked and secure before you lift it up. questions that are asked about returns is, well, how discreet should you be? Should you do it at night where nobody's going to watch? And or should you be very open about it? Again, that's a policy thing. The more open you are about it, then the more opportunity you have to educate and to talk to people and to explain what you're doing. On the other hand, the more opportunity there is for arguments and why are you doing this? So you have to make up your own mind. In general, though, I would say don't shy away from confrontation, because most people are going to be understanding, and that opportunity to explain what's doing may really help with the cat's long-term ability to thrive in that particular community. If it's bad weather, then you just wait. Should you go at day or night? I think usually our concern about that has to do with whether there's traffic in the area. So if there is, and we're concerned about the cat's going to get out of the trap, he's going to bolt, and then we'll do the return like late at night at a quiet hour when there isn't so much traffic. You don't have to release the cat exactly where he or she was trapped, but you want to be within a block or so, somewhere where the cat would normally, that would be part of their regular territory, and they'd be most likely to recognize where they are. Sometimes you hear people say, like, to me, what are really horrifying things, like, well, as long as you let the cat go within a mile, they'll know where they are. Well, that most cats do not have a territory that it has a radius of a mile. Usually it's much smaller than that. On the other hand, if you've got notes that, you know, the finder was kind of an angry person and really doesn't want, it's going to be upset to see the cats come back, well, then don't release the cat right in front of that guy's house. Go to the next block and release the cat there, either behind the house or a block over. You know, just be smart about it. If there is a caretaker in one of those situations where the people bringing the cats in are actually pretty okay with it, then you want the caretaker present if the cat is younger and has probably a much smaller territory than an adult. Certainly, if you're thinking about returning like a mom and a litter of kittens or something like that, and sometimes that's a reality in really high volume shelters in the middle of the summer where they just have no space, that can be done if the caretaker is there. You don't want to take chances with a litter of kittens or even a 12-week-old if you can have the caretaker there and they can point to you exactly where a safe place is to release them. Be aware of public versus private property. You want to be doing most of your releases on public property unless you have permission to be on there. You do get into these kind of semi-public situations sometimes with like a mall's parking lot or an apartment complex. You just have to kind of take it case by case. But to the extent you can release a cat on public land, that's just safer for you. We talked about kittens and caretakers being present. What if you are confronted? You know, I have a three-step process I always talk about with in our workshops about dealing with confrontation. And step number one is just to listen. Just let the people vent. And then if they say something that's reasonable, like, I can't sleep at night because these cats are keeping me up and fighting all night, then express empathy. Just say, yeah, that's not a good thing. I wouldn't want to be woken up every night either by cats. And once somebody's been heard and they have a sense that you're understanding their issues, they tend to relax. And at that point, you can start to explain to him, well, this cat isn't going to keep you up anymore because she's fixed. And by the way, if we could fix most of the cats in this neighborhood, your problem would be pretty much gone. And by the way, if we were to take them all away, then you would just have a new crop of cats, most likely, who would just cause you the same problems. And so again, an opportunity to talk. On the other hand, if you are trying to have a conversation with somebody and they're just persistently belligerent, at that point, you want to just maybe give them your card and say, have a nice day and be on your way. What you don't want to do is, speaking from personal experience, lessons learned the hard way, you do not want to argue with people. It gets you nowhere. It threatens the cat's well-being and it may threaten your well-being. So you have to learn to deal with, be smart about it when people confront you and they're upset. So let's talk a little bit about combining return to field and TNR, because typically you return to field one cat. There are others in that neighborhood. It's going to be pretty rare that that's the only cat around. So how do you combine returning cats to field from the shelter with getting other cats in the neighborhood spayed and neutered? So this would be a situation where there was only one cat. You put him back, he's ear tipped, everything's great, right? But typically, There are, as we mentioned, multiple other cats. So by spaying and neutering this one cat, but the other nine are still unaltered, you've lowered the shelter's euthanasia rate, which is great. You've saved this cat's life, which is an end in itself. But realistically, you haven't done anything to control the community cat population. And when you hear these kind of, some people in our field will say like, oh, return to field also lowers intake. Well, it really doesn't, because it's not getting a high enough sterilization rate. Typically, citizens who are trapping cats and bringing them in are not very knowledgeable about how many cats there actually are. They're not very good at trapping all of them, especially the more difficult ones. And you rarely get enough cats fixed to make a difference population-wise. So this is what return to field, if all that's being done in the community is return to field, this is what it would look like if you're looking at the whole community. You would have groups, colonies of cats scattered throughout, and individual cats here and there being fixed, which is, as I say, which is a goal in itself, because these cats are alone. They're not, they weren't euthanized at the shelter. So lowering euthanasia is an end in itself. But if you want to go even further and not have cats coming in that need to be returned, or at least having a lot fewer, you need to go further than this with your community cat program. So you can combine returning to field with what we call colony level targeted TNR. So what that looks like is you look at the return to field cat as kind of a red flag. So if this cat's here, there must be other cats. And what these programs will do is they'll return the cat, but then they'll spend a little time in the neighborhood, knocking on doors, talking to people, talking to the property owner. Are there more cats? And once they find out that there are and who's feeding them and stuff like that, then they TNR. That would be the blue. They come back and they get the other nine cats fixed. So now you've calmed down the situation. Now you've eliminated this as a source of cats coming in who might need to be returned to field. Remember in that Jacksonville program, how the green bar went down over time and fewer cats needed to be returned to field. That, to me, is the sign of an overall successful community cat program. So this, on a community level, is what combining return to field with that red flag approach, you know, where you use the return to field cat as a sign to go find the other cats in the area. So you'll have different colonies of cats throughout that are now under control and sterilized. Now, there's another way to do that, to combine TNR and return to field, which has to do with doing it on a community level. So we go over in our targeted TNR workshop how it's more efficient to TNR in one, use all your surgeries in one part of the community rather than, it's great to have colonies that are at high sterilization rates, but as their colony size goes down, you may be getting migration from non-TNR colonies that are adjacent to them. So like in our grocery store example, if those cats had been TNR'd and all 10 of them were returned, but then 2 years later or 3 years later, there were only six or seven of them left and there's still enough food for 10, then there's going to be pressure from the colonies that were not TNR'd nearby to fill in the gap, right? And the cats that are there aren't going to be too resistant as long as there's enough food for everybody. So the way you avoid that is by TNRing the whole area. So you can, in this scenario, you continue to return to field any cats that come into the shelters, but instead of targeting the colonies they came from, you decide where would be the most impactful area in our community to target, and you do all the TNR there. So same number of surgeries, but you don't tie them to return to field cats. You tie them to that particular section of your municipality. Again, we have the targeted TNR workshop that goes into this in great detail. And this is a program that PetSmart Charities did with Best Friends. This was the research study that was published by Dan Spearer and Peter Wolf. And we had six shelters. You can see them up on top, six municipal high intake, high euthanasia shelters at some point. And we did this combined return to field with follow-up TNR trapping. And you can, and over a period of 3 years, and you can see that it had a pretty dramatic impact. When you combine all six, intake dropped by about a third, and euthanasia overall dropped by 83%, and that's on average. So it's a very successful program to return to field the cats and then to follow up with trapping and spaying and neutering the rest of the cats, either in the immediate area where the cat was trapped or in a high intake section of the community. This is Albuquerque, which was one of the first cities to embrace this combined RTF and TNR program. And again, what you can see is 2010 was the year before the program began. It started in 2011. And you just see this gradual drop in the red bar, right, which is euthanasia. But what's also fascinating is you also at the same time see a gradual reduction in the intake, as well as in the number of cats being returned to field, although we kind of ran out of data in 2015. But to me, that's a very successful community cat program. You're not only lowering euthanasia, you're lowering intake and reducing the number of cats that have to be returned to field. I mentioned before that we also have a kind of colony level grassroots series with the Community Cats podcast. We have Trapper Tips and Tricks, which are the more advanced training for trappers. We have a whole webinar on the drop trap. Both of those can be seen on YouTube. Just click on the links or go to thecommunitycatspodcast.com. We have one coming up in November on colony caretaking tips and tricks. Again, that's a free webinar and you're welcome to register for it. And I think I've mentioned a couple times, maybe we have our monthly certification workshops on kind of basic training for trap neuter return. Next one is on October 7th. There's a $10 fee and you can register by just clicking on the link on this slide. And that's where we go over the basics of trapping and how to prepare the community and all that good stuff. Okay, so at this point, Stacey, we can take questions.
Super. Excellent. Yeah, we have about 7 minutes. I wanted to mention that if your organization is also interested in like sponsoring that $10 fee for your volunteers, we do have a collaborative partnership with organizations. And so we can do a code and then we bill you, but we want to encourage your organizations to be able to sort of pre-introduce your volunteers to the concept of TNR, because some people will go through and they're like, oh, I didn't realize you have to have a car, or I didn't realize the cat like can sometimes go crazy in the trap, right? I didn't realize you actually need to like bend over and pick up the trap and you've got to make sure that the door doesn't fall open or whatever. So, you know, it's okay in this world. People have their own volunteering needs. I will never be caught bottle feeding a neonatal kitten at night. It's just not in my wheelhouse, but I think it's helpful for folks to go through the virtual session and then they can decide whether this is something they want to pursue with your organization or not. And it helps give them a step and then you can personalize it to your own organization. So we have probably about a dozen groups that participate with us in that way, including municipalities. We do have municipalities who do that also. Just reach out to me if you are interested in doing that. We actually have also some groups that buy one of our t-shirts. And they make their volunteers wear the t-shirts too. So to identify themselves as being part of their organization and a certified trapper, which is kind of interesting too. One question I get a lot from folks is, you're looking at, what is that, 2010 to 2016, and you're seeing all the numbers go down, which is all great. It's this beautiful romantic picture. Is the behavior at that front door or when people reach out about cats in 2010, was the behavior different than in 2016? Because we're hearing a lot about shelters just saying we're closed, capacity for care is full, we can't do this. There's just like, it seems like, are we talking apples to apples from 2010 to 2016 or was there a behavior change?
Yeah, you always want to look at, you know, if we're talking about what's the size of the community cat population in that community, you can't necessarily get a read on that only through shelter data, because there's a lot of things that could influence shelter data. Like you say, they could change their hours, they could change their policies. During COVID, a lot of shelters really closed their doors. So that can be a very difficult way to assess community cat populations, but it's a very easy way to assess what's going on in the community, right? But in this particular case, I know for a certainty that from 2010 through 2014, that the shelter, because that was the grant period, that the shelter policies did not change, that these results were directly attributed to the combined, what we call the Community Cat Project, the combined return to field and TNR program.
The other thing that I am finding is in areas where that return to field or the, at our Sunday spay neuter clinics in Massachusetts, we have
very few cats coming from a local area, more cats coming from a 2 to 3 hour drive into those clinics because of the area that those areas just haven't had access to the services and those folks are willing to drive in. However, in the areas that are still close to that clinic, we do have a pretty high volume of folks taking advantage of the owned affordable spay neuter services. So where that outdoor TNR number may be going down, I still think that there's a pretty heavy level of low cost and affordable spay neuter services for owned cats that needs to kind of always be happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that in Jacksonville, like I say, the returns and field program is not lowering your intake. Its influence on intake would be in the shelter serving as a model for how do you handle community cats, right? Because people in the community are going to look to the shelter for guidance. And when the shelter, if the shelter is euthanizing free roaming cats, then what they're teaching the community is if you got a problem with a cat, drop them off here and we'll take care of it for you. On the other hand, if the shelter is spaying and or neutering the cat, then returning the cat back outside, that's teaching the community the way to deal with your problems is by fixing the cat. And they're going to start looking for other resources to do that. So that's why in Jacksonville, from the advent of the Return to Field program, First Coast No More Homeless Pets, which is a private clinic, saw the number of TNR surgeries skyrocket because that's now what the municipal agency was teaching people to do, which is don't just dump them on us, take them to a clinic and take care of it yourself. So that's kind of an indirect effect that this kind of a program can have. But when this Return to Field is like in Albuquerque, what you see here, when the Return to Field is combined with a very strategic approach to TNR, not just fixing cats randomly, but in very specific locations, that definitely can have an impact on the number of cats coming in. You could quibble about the data from any one shelter.
Yep.
But when you see it across the board, like here, and you're getting these results everywhere you're implementing this program, that strongly suggests that the program is having a significant impact and it's not some random factor.
I know it's 4 o'clock. But I have two follow questions. I can't decide which is more important. So one is an organization said they've stopped giving FVRCP. Why isn't it important for the health of the community cat? And then also, I know your slide did not mention microchipping. So that's the first question. The second question is just folks are asking about update on Maui and the cats.
Oh, sure. Well, FVRCP, I think what a lot of people don't realize is there has been research done on the effectiveness of one shot. And it's by Dr. Julie Levy, and she's shown that it is months later, the one shot has still significant a positive impact on the cat. So if you can spare a cat down the road from developing rhinotracheitis or some type of viral disease, that's great. It's not usually standard, but there's a strong movement now led by the academic veterinarians like Dr. Levy to make it part of the standard protocol. The microchipping, I think it's a great idea, especially for return to field cats, because if they do come back to your shelter, it gives you really valuable information about the cat's history. And it wasn't standard for a long time because it was felt like the cost was that money was better spent on more spay neuter. But now the cost is so low, it's come down so much that I think it's still optional, but a very good idea. As far as what's going on in Maui, it's kind of like a good news, bad news situation where, you know, it's like the devastation. We work in the burn zone every day, Susie and I. We're in charge of coordinating the rescue and recovery of all the animals that are in there, and it's 5.5 square miles. And when people first got in there, the thought was nothing could have survived this. I mean, you literally have that community burnt to the ground. But what we learned is what happened was the cats, they ran into the storm drains. They got under the fire. And then they, after the danger was passed, they started coming out, and we're finding the good news is there are hundreds of cats that have survived. So, you know, it's become a struggle about, well, what are you going to do with them? They can't really stay there on a long-term basis. It's too dangerous. Plus, they're going to rebuild the whole town eventually. So what we're doing now is as plans are made for where are we going to relocate these cats, if anybody out there is interested in doing a responsible relocation of some of the Maui fire cats, let us know. We'll refer you to the Maui Humane Society. In the meantime, we're We've got now 73 feeding stations spread throughout the fire zone that are trying our best to keep them full on a daily basis. And meantime, we go in at night, not just Susie and I, but we have Field Haven Felines Center is a partner in this, as well as Maui Humane Society. We go in there at night and we identify, we try to find cats that were burnt, or we've even found young kittens that survived. We found kittens that were 3 weeks old at the time of the fire that survived. Pet cats, people who have identified their pets. So we go in there at night and we try to target these guys and pull them out right away and maintain the rest of the population until we have a place to bring them.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you both, you, Susie, Maui Humane, everybody else who's been on the ground, and of course, Joy and the Field Haven team coming in. Just great response. It's, you know, we at the Community Cats podcast, we're talking about trying to put together some sort of programming to help with regards to disasters. Not that we think or hope anything like this would ever happen again, but we're dealing with hurricanes all the time, it seems like, and, you know, other natural mudslides, yeah, other natural disasters. So just trying to maybe be prepared and have some strategy for our community cat programs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say that the folks from Field Haven coming in, because they have extensive experience with what was the campfire, which was in Paradise, where that whole town burnt to the ground. Their experience in dealing with that has definitely been a huge help in our dealing with this, which suggests that there is a protocol to follow that will save a lot of lives. And so, yeah, we need to get that down on paper and start training people on, God forbid this happens in an area you're at, these are the first steps you should take. This is the next phase. And so it's just a great help that we're not trying to reinvent the wheel, that we have Joy Smith and Field Haven to tell us. Like when the experts were coming in and saying there's nothing here could have survived, Joy was on with us saying, you're going to find hundreds of cats. Everybody thinks there's nobody survives, but you will find hundreds of cats. And she was right. So experience in Heath is really valuable.
I know you have a Maui fire fund. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I'm assuming you have enough supplies and all the things that you need to go and take care of those 73 feeding locations. But with regards to the monetary resources, that fund could still use donations.
Yeah, for sure. Because, you know, this effort will probably last, our estimation is, a minimum of 6 months and more likely a year. So we're going to have to keep at this for quite a long time. So that, yeah, there was this enormous inflow of people's generosity and resources. And so there's a lot here right now, but that might not be the case in 5 months or 6 months. And we need to be prepared to sustain this. And certainly given the amount of time it takes and whatever financial support we can get is a huge help.
Right. I mean, the reality is that the Neighborhood Cats team has basically dropped a lot of things to be able to help those cats over in the burn zone. So therefore, organizationally, you have to get other resources to keep your business going, the national programs and all that kind of stuff.
Well, so just even basic fundraising. Yeah. I mean, everybody's been very understanding, but because we just told them, like the direct mail people or the other people we work with and in other development, we just said, you just expect us to be missing deadlines and not giving you the reports that you're asking for. So,
it's tough because you're a small business. This is like a small nonprofit business model, and it's very challenging, but it could happen to any of us. Right. And so we're going to unfortunately learn through you and Susie how you survived through that. And Field Haven's not a big organization either. And I think they sacrificed a lot of their organization during that period of time to go out there and help those fire cats. So it's tough.
Yeah, but that's what we're here for. Yeah. We're not here to build a big organization where everybody gets a nice salary. We're here to help the cats. And so whatever sacrifices are needed, but people have been extremely generous when it comes to fundraising for this particular disaster.
Cool. Well, I am sorry, folks, I went over, but you are the AP class. Brian, I want to thank you so much.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.